3150. That's 313-845-9750.
Listener-supported non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. You are listening to WHFR Dearborn.
Happy Friday, happy spring, and welcome to this, the March 28th edition of the WHFR Journal. Susan McGraw with you. We are celebrating our HFC Hawks, the athletes, the department, the coaches, the staff, and everybody that's involved in giving us some great athletic viewing and experience. That's on the top of my mind these days. I had the pleasure of going to one of the exciting NJCAA watch parties that the Hawks men's basketball team were participating in this past week. And oh my gosh, just so exciting, so much going on. We needed to go to the top. So of course, we went and asked our dear friend, Rochelle Taylor, to share some insight on what's happening with HFC Athletics. Rochelle is the athletic director of Henry Ford College. She's the leader of the Hawks, let's put it that way. Rochelle, wow, congratulations on all the successes that your teams are sort of basking us in right now.
Thank you. And thanks for having me on today right after our men's basketball season. So, yeah, I think that it was great. You know, we feel like in athletics, we're all about trying to help with the campus spirit. We're the spirit of the campus. And it was just so nice to know that we had faculty, staff, students all out cheering for our Hawks here on campus when we were in Danville, Illinois, making a run for a national championship. So it was great for everyone. And thanks so much for having me here.
Oh, sure. It was fun seeing you on the big screen as well, by the way. And our president, we had Russ Cavalluna on one side and you on the other side, and just that amazing game. So, yeah, this really is a school, connection all the way around. Tell us a little bit about how things wrapped up for those that maybe haven't been following. Didn't get quite where we'd hoped, but boy, lots to be proud of.
I tell you, lots to be proud of. It was our fourth time competing at the national championship, which there are only 20 schools in the nation that make it to a national championship for men's basketball. It was our fourth time in 5 years being there. So that's just a testament to our coaching staff, to the players that we recruit, to their dedication, their goal. So the NJCAA tournament, unlike NCAA, which is everyone's watching March Madness right now, that's a one and done. You know, you lose one game, you're out. The NJCAA tournament, it's a double elimination. So every team comes and if you lose two games, you're out. So you want to just hang on as long as you can. It's a very long week. We started playing on Monday, and the championship game is Saturday night. So that's our goal, to be there Saturday night. Unfortunately, we left on Friday afternoon, so we did lose our second game. But it was very exciting. Our first loss was to Parkland. Community College, and we lost by 2 points. They were a number four seed. Parkland ended up making it to the championship game and losing by 1 point to a school out of Arizona. So we lost the 2 points to a team that was ended up being, that close to being a national championship. It's the kind of thing where the ball bounces in or bounces out. I really feel like we had as good a chance to win that game as anyone, and I feel like if we won that game, we would have been soaring to that national championship as well. But very, very proud of our team, as I said, as a coaching staff, and we start all over again. We have recruits in the building now. And we're starting to build it. So our goal is to be right back there next year. And then it's just exciting that it's just every week try to see if we're able to get back to that tournament.
Yeah, well, Henry Ford College has for some time, but I mean, like now more than ever in recent years that I have been involved in following the athletics. I mean, we're a force to be reckoned with, for crying out loud. I mean, we've got some past national champions, that we can brag about, and we've got some
Absolutely.
people playing in the higher levels and so on. So,
Absolutely.
but how does that feel? What's that all about? It doesn't happen overnight, but clearly,
No, it doesn't
boy.
happen overnight. So it's really, I can look back and feel like I'm really proud to see how our programs have grown. When I came on, we had in 2009 was the first time our men's basketball team had been at a national championship. And then there was a long pause until, as I said, over the last 5 years, we've been there four times. So that just means that it takes time. You have to build a reputation in the community. You have to show that you care about your students. And people have to see that our players are moving on and playing at four-year schools. They're seeing that they're moving on and playing internationally. We have a number of former athletes playing overseas. They have to see that they're getting their degrees, which is the most important. And while we would have loved to bring back that national championship, what's even more important is having a four-year school coach in our gym 2 days ago looking at players saying, "Hey, we want to bring you to Alabama State and see if this will be a good fit for you." It's all about really giving these student athletes in all our sports a chance to play here, be seen on a national level, and then being able to move on and get their bachelor's degree. We have players who have received their master's degree all under the athletics by being able to play, basketball or softball or baseball or whatever sport. So really, that's the most gratifying. That's what it's all about. Just sending our players on and representing Henry Ford all over the country. We say our hawks fly everywhere. So they play for us for 2 years and they have opportunities that they would not have had they not been at Henry Ford. That's the most, that is what's most gratifying, I think, to us on campus, the coaches and everyone.
Rochelle, for me as an instructor here at Henry Ford College, it's so much fun when I get a Hawks athlete in one of my classes. They tend to take some of our media classes. I think it's a great class actually for our athletes, frankly, because it gives them sort of some media literacy skills that every young person, every student should have. But I love when our student athletes are in some of our classes, and they do a really good job. And there's this tendency to think that they're just sliding through because they're only focused on athletics. But I recognize, and I've heard, and I have, front row seat witness to the fact that they are really working so hard as a student as well as an athlete, and that is showing successfully in GPAs and stuff, isn't it?
Absolutely. We actually had a very good fall semester as an athletic department. And about a year ago, in January of 2024, we added a new position in our athletic department. We have an associate athletic director for academic support. That's Kirk Bradley. So he's able to really focus on the academic progress and success of our student athletes. I kind of look at it like I work with the athlete side. He's the student side of student athlete, and that allows me to kind of focus on the athlete side of student athlete. But it's made a tremendous difference just in being able to help. We have so many incoming freshmen. Some of them are first-time college students. It's nice to have someone who's just kind of focused on making sure they know their responsibilities, how much time they need to put in. Do they need a tutor? We do progress reports. That's how you know you have student athletes there. But when we see something that's amiss, then that it kind of gives them an opportunity. And there's so much, even though these students are taking 12 credit hours, they're full-time students, they're practicing and competing, there's still a lot of free time in their day from when you think about being in high school when your day is very structured from 8 to 3 and you know exactly what you're doing. You're taking a class maybe on Mondays and Wednesdays. So there's still a lot of free time there. And until you really get it and learn how to manage and understand that it's not just in the classroom time, you need to be putting in some time outside as well. That's why it's so important for Kirk's position to just kind of keep our student athletes on track. And so we saw our department-wide team GPA go from the fall of 2023 from 2.44 to a 2.70 this past fall semester. And I just think it's that added layer of having someone who's reminding them to get over to that writing center. You have a paper due. If you're struggling with how to kind of get it formulated, go over. They can help you in the writing center. They can help you in the learning lab, and just staying on top of our students. And a lot of them come right here and they just do their homework. They do their studying right here. We have two new study areas in our own building now. And it just has made a huge difference. And so we just want to continue to see that team GPA rise for all our student athletes.
Oh, that's just wonderful to hear. Well, basketball wrapping up, but there's, every season there's a sport. We had wrestling kind of, that's kind of winding down at this point or has wound down. And
So, yes, wrestling, we had eight wrestlers individual. So that's more of an individual sport. So we had 8 of 10, there are 10 weight classes, 8 of our wrestlers and 8 of our weight classes did qualify to make it to the national tournament. So they had a chance to, just as men's basketball, compete against the best in the nation. And I mean, wrestling is one of those sports. It is grueling. It's absolutely grueling. And so while we have had 6 All-Americans come out of our wrestling program this year, we had one wrestler who, had he won his last bout, he would have been in the All-American round. And it was one of those things with 5 seconds to go, he was up. And we're like, hold on, hold on. And I know that 5 seconds probably felt like 5 minutes, but you got somebody else on the other end who's trying to make it as well to become an All-American. I mean, literally, the other wrestler scored a point, at the 5 second mark, and we just couldn't get that point back. And so we were that close to coming home with another All-American. But I tell you, what it takes to be out there on that mat is amazing. And I was at that championship cheering those wrestlers on. And I tell you, when they leave that mat, there's nothing left. They can hardly walk off the mat. They have left it all there. And that's all you can ask for, So we're very proud of our wrestling team as well. But while I was at men's basketball nationals in Danville, Illinois last week, we were already starting. We had baseball playing already. Luckily the weather was nice enough. And so we've got a baseball. I'm dressed for softball right now. We're going to be going to softball. And so we're the spring sports are, they're like, hey, it's our time. Scoot over basketball, scoot over wrestling. It's time for us to shine. And that's exactly what they're doing right now, our spring sports. And then we've got golf that will start in about 2 weeks.
Okay. One of my favorite experiences of the of HFC Hawks athletics was having the pleasure of seeing a men's baseball game at the old ballpark at Michigan and
Oh,
Trumbull. It was such a
yes.
cool thing. So tell
Yes.
us a little bit about that connection, that relationship, and that amazing opportunity for our young athletes.
Amazing, amazing. So when the Tigers moved and created Comerica Park, and that original baseball lot at Trumbull in Michigan was there, and the city ended up converting that into a community. The Detroit PAL, Police Athletic League, has their headquarters there, and they manage that field. It's a beautiful turf field. It has the lights, and the amazing thing about it is the home plate is the original spot where every major leaguer stood. The foul line, they kept the complete the same foul poles. So there's so much history there, and for our team and for to be able to play their home games there, it's amazing. Every team in our conference loves to come play Henry Ford. just because they get a chance to play in the corner ballpark. We don't practice there, but we do. That is our home field. It's an amazing field. It's an amazing. It is an amazing venue, and I would encourage anyone to have a chance to come down. It's free admission. Free to get in. Our games are typically double headers, so we're gonna be out there 4 or 5 hours. Every time we play, but it's a fantastic opportunity for our players to play sometimes under the lights on such a historic field.
We talk about opportunities on the, on the field, in on the mat, on the court, and so on. I also recognize that our players, while they're juggling their practices and their games and their schooling, they're kind of required to step it up a little bit with some things related to kind of helping others with community service. I know we just sort of wrapped up the Hunger Games, which I love hearing about. Tell us a little bit about that for listeners that may not be familiar.
Well, we really philosophically, I believe, and I was an athlete myself. I started competing competing when I was 9 years old. So, and I was competing at a national level when I was like 11 or 12. So, but when I think back, and to me, for any athlete, I believe. But when I think back in my own life, there were so many coaches I had that just, they don't get, they weren't getting paid. In youth sports, you're not really getting paid to coach. I had a coach who would work all day on his way home, pick me up, take me to the track, go through an hour and a half, 2 hour workout, drop me off at home, then go to his own family and now have dinner and do the things he needs to do with his own family. And to really excel in youth sports, to excel at this level, our student athletes have been participating in sports for a long time, and there are parents who are bringing the snacks to the game for the whole team. And I mean, you just think about it. I don't think that you can have an experience and not have had someone that went out of their way to make that experience good for you. So we just determined that here at Henry Ford, our student athletes, no matter where you're coming from, what your own background is, there's something you have that you can give back to someone else. So one of the things that we do as a department every year in the winter semester is the Hunger Games. We select one men's and women's basketball game, and rather than receive our admission at the door, anything that comes in at the door goes directly to support the Hawk's Nest, which is the student food pantry here on campus. And we also ask, rather than even making the donation, really instead of paying the fee to get in, that bring 5 canned goods. And again, all of the donations go directly to support our student food pantry, and all of our teams are involved in that as well. And then during the fall semester and the rest of the year, we ask each team to just select something that's important to them, a cause that's important to them. And they have the entire year to, as a team, just determine how they're gonna go back and help the community in some manner. And I think that that's important. As I said, it's a great way to build a team culture, build a team bonding, give back to the community. That's what it's all about. So it's not just about focusing on yourself, but for one day, truly we can look and try to help someone else.
Yeah, ooh, life lessons for our student athletes. That's incredible. We're talking with Athletic Director Rochelle Taylor from Henry Ford College Hawks, speaking about the Associate Director of Athletics and the academic side, Kirk Bradley, who we enjoyed just not that long ago, hearing a nice presentation from him about so much going on with students. And there's always, I can feel just truly that pride just coming out of everything that he says, that you're saying, anybody associated with Henry Ford Hawks athletics just clearly is being driven not only by the desire to win, but that just that desire to be the very best and instill the very best. And that means a lot of different things, as we've already examined, for our students, which is just incredible. So we are grateful for that. And also, I think as a commuter college, as a community college, opportunities to get our students that come to campus or that maybe typically don't because they're doing online education, a reason to come to campus, you know, to celebrate these teams and be a part of these events. And I know, to get into games for students and staff of the college, the stuff going on campus is free. And that's, you know, right there is an opportunity. So what can you say to those students that are listening and such that maybe haven't experienced this part of Henry Ford College yet?
Right. And I hate every day or any time that I find out that there's a student or employee on this campus that doesn't know we have an athletic, don't know that we have an athletic department. That really, you know, is disappointing for me, to me, because I think it's such a great opportunity to come out. And who doesn't, everyone wants to rally around a team. I mean, it takes your mind off of everything else that's going on at that time. And so I know that I would encourage everyone, you can always check our Henry Ford College website. Our athletic site is always up to date. Let's look at a baseball or softball schedule. If we get rained out, you'll know that day. We instantly put on the website, hey, that game's postponed. It's going to be replayed on such a day. So even better than any printed schedule, you just want to go to the website and check that out. But we try to make it a nice, fun environment for anyone who's coming out. And I will add that, and you are aware of this, Susan, that for those who cannot make it out to our campus or to one of our sites, but our campus events, which would be volleyball, men's basketball, women's basketball, and wrestling, we do live stream those, and that's on the Henry Ford College YouTube channel, so that you can still join in on the fun and you can still cheer on. It's almost like having a watch party in your own home at that point throughout the whole season. And I think our game announcers, our cameramen, they do a great job covering everything. So we try to make it as easy as possible for everyone to come out and have a chance to know what's going on with athletics and to follow and cheer. And, you know, when you get a chance to see the players, you know, you get a little more invested. You know, everybody has their favorite player. This one shoots the 3-point all the time. This one's going to, when's the next time is he going to dunk? You know, everybody kind of gets their favorite player out there. And so, you know, it's a great environment. And I know that our student athletes enjoy playing in front of spectators. Of course, their parents are usually there and their friends, but, you know, if we could get a nice contingent of our student body and our, you know, our employees and, of course, our community members that are listening to really support the Hawks. We are Dearborn's Community College, and, you know, we love representing this city. We love representing this college, and we love showing off, you know, really. So everyone's always, always welcome.
Yeah. And how cool to potentially see a classmate playing, you know, at this exactly. level, at this quality.
That's and it's cool for the students to look and see, like, they had an experience, oh, wow, my English teacher came out, or, you know, like it makes a difference to them as well. Like, oh, wow. Okay. So I think it's win-win for everybody.
Yeah, no doubt. You mentioned just a moment ago women's basketball, and we have women's sports here at HFC as well. And you mentioned volleyball. Tell us a little bit about what's happening in those areas.
So volleyball is a fall sport. They compete in September and October. Coach Chambers is our head women's coach, and she is a former athlete here at Henry Ford. She was a dual sport athlete, volleyball and basketball. And I'm going to tell you that I believe when I look at the organization of a team, that Coach Chambers does an outstanding job. She's really created a culture for her volleyball program. And I think we are just beginning to see the benefits of that. She has just completed 3 years, and it really takes about 3 years for a new coach to really come in and build a culture and a program. And so in the community, we used to struggle a little bit with numbers, being able to really recruit volleyball players that wanted to come to Henry Ford. And now she has exceeded her roster. I keep reminding her, we don't have the budget for that many, but it's a great sign that we are now attracting volleyball players who want to come and play at Henry Ford. So I'm really hoping that this fall, next fall, they will have a successful season. They're already in here competing, practicing this spring. There's a very short spring window that the NJCAA allows volleyball teams to go. They're going to be competing this Saturday at Siena Heights. So she's got her team already. This is earlier for her than any, already working out twice a week, and they're going to be able to go and play on Saturday and see where they are. And that's going to give them that momentum to go throughout the summer and then be ready in the fall, I believe. So really, really excited about where volleyball is going as she has completed 3 years and has really had a chance to put her flavor and her stamp on women's volleyball here at Henry Ford. Now, women's basketball, we've just had a coaching change. We just announced a new coach last week, late last week. Coach Chuck Perez was an assistant on our staff this past year. He's a former high school coach for a very successful high school coach in the Downriver area at several schools. He's had a year under his belt as an assistant, and he's going to be taking over as head coach. And he's been out recruiting even when he had an interim tag to him. And we're going to be having some recruits in the gym on Saturday. So he's building his program for his team for next year, you know, with some juniors and seniors coming out to open gym. And again, when you have a coaching change, you know, you still have to give a few years for them to really get it together. So it'll be very important for us to be able to have a very stable coaching staff so that we can start seeing that team turn around. However, academically, they were one of the our team this year. Women's basketball was one of the highest team GPAs last year, so they're doing a great job recruiting, you know, true students and athletes. And now we just want to get them on the court as prepared as possible so that they can. I would love to have nothing more than to be juggling between going to the men's nationals and the women's nationals. Like, where do I go? Because they happen at the same time, you know. I'd love to be able to say, oh my God, I have to go here on Monday and then I want to see the women. So I'm watching them on live stream or something like that. So that's our goal. I want to be able to be so busy I can't even keep up with all our teams that are at the national championship. So yeah, so that's what's been going on with those two sports.
That will be a great problem to have, and I trust that we will have that sometime down the road. That's amazing. Rochelle Taylor is the athletic director here at Henry Ford College. She's the lead Hawk, the leader of the HFC Hawks athletics. You know, we've been talking about different sports that we, oh yeah, this is it's kind of a typical thing for a college and pretty cool for a community college to have the softball, the baseball, the even the wrestling, you know, frankly, the volleyball and so on. But I think we'd be remiss if we didn't even maybe bring up this whole roller hockey thing, especially since we have some bragging rights of being former national champs here at Henry Ford.
Right. So roller hockey's been here on our campus since 2017. Now they're a club sport. It's not sponsored at the NJCAA level, so they're a club sport. And actually, when we started our program in 2017, there was a whole community college division. And we competed against other community colleges and we did win the national championship. But after the lockdown of COVID, the other community colleges just little by little just stopped sponsoring the sport. So we are actually the only community college in the country still operating a roller hockey club. And it is amazing because our conference consists of University of Michigan, Michigan State, Ohio State, you know, Miami of Ohio, you know, so we're competing against 4-year schools and top, you know, very large 4-year schools. And the way their national championship works is they look at the teams compete all year, and then you have to be invited to the national championship. They only invited eight division, and we're actually competing at a Division One level. They invited eight Division One schools this year, and Henry Ford is one of those. It's primarily because we show well when we do compete at the national level. I think we made the Final Four 2 years ago. We won it about 4 years ago, again at that community college level. So they'll actually be competing in Fort Myers, Florida, which is a great place to visit, starting on April 2nd. Their very first game will be against University of Arizona. The next day, they're going to play Arizona State and Lindenwood University. And based on how they play in that, they call that pool play. So how they come out against those teams will determine if there's how they're seeded and if they move forward to the championship. That would be that Friday and Saturday. So they are very, very excited. We're very proud of them as well. And it's a great opportunity for them to just see how they're stacking up against some huge, huge schools. So Little Henry Ford in Dearborn, Michigan is really representing once again on a national stage. So we couldn't be more happy about it.
Yeah, that's just got to be such a cool feeling. And especially, I would think, just the fact that the differentiation between university, community college, maybe expectations from people around the country and these other schools is pretty low, but that's got to work in your, to your to our
Right.
advantage, huh?
Yeah, I sit in the stand and I hear people say, "Henry Ford, where is that? What Henry Ford College? What? Where is that?" And I'm happy to say, "Oh, we're in Dearborn, Michigan. We're a community college. We're a two-year school." And they're like, "Really?" And they're really always very surprised.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, it has been a pleasure getting to catch up on all of this action. So much activity going on, and we just did not want to let any more time go by, especially with the NJCAA just wrapping up. And
Yeah.
to not only say congratulations to you and your entire team and all of the team members, all of the athletes, but also just to kind of have a look ahead and prep for the baseball and the softball, and invite our community, not only our campus community but our listening community, to participate. Participate in these things. Such
Absolutely.
great, yeah, such great entertainment at this level, for people that love sports and or for people that love HFC, right?
Exactly.
It's a win-win. So,
Win-win.
how can we find out all of these, the details, the times and days of the games and so on, so we can get more people in those seats?
So again, the most accurate information is always at hfcc.edu/athletics on the HFCC general website, and you will be able to see our schedules, where we play, our team rosters are there. You can follow, actually, if you don't make the games, you can always follow on that website. It has our win-loss record. You can see everything that we're doing on every day. I would want to point out and let the listeners know, now I mentioned we have a new baseball coach. It's his first year. We're leading the conference right now. We are already coming in, putting a little stake down saying Henry Ford has not taken any slip back from making a coaching change. And we actually are really, really hopeful to make a great regional run and a national run with our baseball program as well. But the website is always going to give you the best opportunity. And of course, feel free to contact the athletic office at 313-317-4138 if you have questions or any comments or concerns, and we'll be happy to direct you to where our Hawks are at any given day and time.
All right, Rochelle, thank you to you, Kirk, the entire team, and all those hardworking student athletes. We're just so grateful for you providing us this opportunity to be connected as Hawks, to support our teams and support the next generation of athletes and great students and just really well-rounded human beings. So
Thank you.
really, really appreciate you. Thanks so much.
Absolutely.
And go Hawks. We're going to segue over as we wrap up the month of March and Women's History Month, our series on women's history. And this piece from PRX Public Radio Exchange came out in 2002. It is titled The Foremother of Women's History, and it is a session called Radio Curious. Enjoy.
Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Dr. Gerda Lerner, a leader in the development of the academic genre of women's history, is our guest in this edition of Radio Curious. She was a major leader in the movement to study and record the history of women. Gerda Lerner led an extraordinary life from April 30th, 1920 to January 2nd, 2013. She was a historian, author, and teacher, and ultimately a professor emeritus of history at the University of Wisconsin. Her academic work has been characterized by the attention she drew to the differences among women in class, race, and sexual orientation. She grew up in Vienna, Austria, suffered in the Nazi persecution of the European Jews, came to the United States as a teenager and married a writer who was subsequently blacklisted in the 1950s. She entered Columbia University in 1958, originally to take a few classes. And by 1966, she had earned a doctorate in history. Fireweed, a political autobiography, is her story of her life up to the time she enrolled in Columbia University. Professor Lerner and I visited by phone from her home in Wisconsin in October of 2002 and began with her description of why the distinctions among women of class, race, and sexual orientation are important.
First of all, when we are speaking about women and their history, I think we have to understand we're speaking about the majority of humankind. We're not speaking about a small minority group that can be easily identified by one or another characteristic. And I think this has been one of the important discoveries that people that have tried to resurrect the history of women have had to deal with. We cannot make generalizations about women any more than we can make valid generalization about men as a group. They're too large and too varied. So what we have come to see is that whatever we study and whatever we say about women has to be qualified or distinguished by paying attention to the location of the women, who they are, which particular subgroup they might fit into.
In describing those subgroups, are there some particular key points or classifications that you found to be important?
Well, race in America is a very important divider, you know, and color. I mean, race is an invalid term, but it's used as a metaphor for distinguishing people of color from so-called white people. And class, the economic location, the kind of work you do, you know, the kind of economic resources you have access to, the kind of educational resources a woman has access to. Religion is an important marker. There are many different markers. In one of the achievements of women's history has been to call attention also to differences based on sexual orientation. Those have, in the past, have been totally overlooked. We just assumed everybody was alike under the rubric women, and that isn't so. All right. So this is one of the refinements that the field has made as it has grown.
In terms of Fireweed, your political autobiography, what motivated you to write it?
Well, a number of things. I wanted to really look back on my life. I'm now in my, ninth decade. I'm over 80 years old, so you look back on your life and you try to see what does it add up to. I also felt that I had a very interesting life in a good sense and in a bad sense. I mean, spare me from interesting lives.
It's like the Chinese say, may you live in an interesting time.
Yeah, I lived in an interesting time, you could say, in a number of interesting times. And I felt that that life experience shaped a lot of my thinking. And since I have been very successful in my career as a historian, people think of me as only the person, you know, that had all these successes and published one book after another and no problems, you know, when in fact it was all based on a long life of almost 50 years of attempts and failures and wrong directions and choices that led into dead ends and so forth. So I felt that that was a very important thing to share with the people who honor me and admire my work. I wanted to...
Could you share with us some of your experiences before you moved into the world of academics?
I grew up in Vienna, and I grew up in a sheltered middle-class environment with all the benefits thereof. And from one day to the next, I was defined by the new government as belonging to a group that was worse than vermin. We weren't even human. And we had no rights, and we had no recourse, and we had nobody to appeal to when we were abused. And that was a very shattering experience, apart from the actual experience of the persecution. But the concept that you could do this to human beings, you know, which of course is true all over the world, and it's true in every place, but... We never know it until it happens to us or until it touches us directly. And it touched me directly very early in life. So I write about that, and I describe my experience in a Nazi jail as a hostage for my father, and the experience of being stateless and having no country that would accept me until I came to the United States. So all these things really had a great impact on me.
For some people who suffered under the Nazi regime, there was emotional defeat. For you, it seems like it was a foundational framework for your successes later in life.
Well, of course, you have to look at it that way, that I didn't know that at the time. I mean, from where I was sitting... In 1939, didn't look like there were going to be great successes ahead. That's something that I had to, you know, fight through and earn. And I should say that, yes, I was a, I mean, part of what I'm describing in the book is an attitude of being a resistor, of resisting conformity, of resisting pessimism. Right. And I try to describe how that happened.
Can you describe how that happened for us now?
I described that I had a family situation in which I early learned to resist authority and to mistrust it. Okay? I never felt comfortable with people telling me in an authoritative way what I was supposed to do, to think, and to act. And I think that carried over into the political.
Do you think that that resistance against authority was unique to you or unique to the time and the culture from where you came?
No, certainly not unique to the culture and the time. As you said, many people went through that experience and became totally defeated by it. Other people went through the experience and became very conservative. All right? No, I think that was unique to me. And that's part of what I explore in the book with as much detail as I can. And then I describe my, you know, my struggle in America to, first of all, to become an American, to become an American writer, which was a great goal I had. I never, you know, I thought I, my main goal, as a young woman, was to become a writer and to write in English. So learning to speak a second language well enough to be a writer in it, that was a long struggle. And I spend a lot of time in this book describing my growth as a writer and my various... That was a difficult struggle because I wasn't successful. I was intermittently successful and then not for many years, and I had to really work hard on that. And
the change that brought about your success? Is there
Well, that's only as a writer, only after I became an academic. See, that was the thing. I mean, before that, I had some work published.
Well, you had a series of novels that characterized social situations that you had observed, integration in neighborhoods in New York.
Right. And, well, I had I wrote one novel about the coming of fascism, which was which I struggled for 12 years to write in English, and then I couldn't place it in America. It was, they told me then it was 12 years after the end of World War II, and fascism was no longer of interest to the publishers. And then the book was translated and appeared in Vienna, in Austria, and was very successful there. And then later I helped to organize a publishing venture for, you know, sort of a cooperative for writers publishing their own work. And it was published in America, and it was quite well received. And then I wrote a novel about housing integration, and I was told that that was a public a subject of no interest when I presented it to publishers 2 years before the start of the civil rights movement. So my timing was never very good.
You were ahead of the curve.
I was either behind the curve or ahead of the curve, but never quite in the middle of it. But then when I started as an academic, when I started publishing, everything I wrote was immediately accepted and widely distributed and very successful. So I can't explain why that is. So maybe I learned to write better, or maybe the credentials helped.
Well, I'd like to ask you about your political activities before you became an academic. But first, I'd like to tell our listeners that this week we're talking with Dr. Gerda Lerner about her recent book called Fireweed, a Political Autobiography. Dr. Lerner is a retired professor from the University of Wisconsin and one of the pioneers in the creation of the academic genre of women's history. Dr. Lerner, can you tell us about the political experiences that you had before you became an academic?
Well, I went through the coming of fascism in Austria, and as a young student, I was marginally active in the anti-fascist student movement, which meant that I took considerable risk. Even being marginally involved, you risked a year or two in jail. So that kind of radicalized me. And then when I came to the United States, I fell in with a group of left-wing people. My husband, my lifelong partner, Carl Lerner, was a communist when I met him, and his friends were all people who had sort of joined the left-wing radicalism during the Depression and were very active in the theater and in the film world. And so through them, I got into that circle. And when we moved to Hollywood just prior to the outbreak of World War II, and in that period then, during the war, my husband entered the film business, and we were very involved in the unionization struggles in the film business. And in the course of this, I also joined the Communist Party and was active in neighborhood work and childcare work and in work.
What sort of things were they? Were they?
Well, in the war, it was mostly to help the war effort to promote collaboration in the post-war world with to make sure that fascism was defeated and not just Germany. And then I got involved in a women's organization after World War II called the Congress of American Women, and that was a really wonderful organization, quite large at the time, but it was attacked by the government in the Cold War period because it was affiliated with an international women's movement, and that was a post-war women's movement in which 48 women from 48 countries joined together, and their interest was in maintenance of peace and no use of atomic weapons. Okay, that of course that put us into opposition with the policy of the U.S. government, and then a racial sort of. Not racial integration, it was an American thing, but respect for people of different cultures and races, and a very strong emphasis on child care, education, and health protection for children. And this American affiliate was a very active organization in which for 4 years black and white women organized by the tens of thousands. What characterized the organization was that it had a great interest in women's history and celebrated various events of the past, and that appealed to me a lot. So my interest in women's history was way ahead, again, my timing was different, was ahead of the curve of everybody getting an interest in that in the late 60s. This organization was destroyed, essentially, by the Attorney General certifying it as a subversive organization and demanding that all its board members register as foreign agents, which they, of course, refused to do since they weren't foreign agents of anybody.
Can you explain the authority that the United States Attorney General had at that time to identify subversive organizations?
Yeah, it was the McCarran Act. And all of it was declared unconstitutional about 20 years later. But by that time, the damage had been done. Listed about 60 or 70 organizations, some of them just totally innocuous organizations that had no political aim. Some of them organizations that were working for racial integration. And when an organization was listed, it was virtually destroyed because the penalties were very high, and people were faced with the choice of declaring themselves to be agents of a foreign government when they never even had any contact with anybody in the foreign government. I mean, it was a very, very dangerous precedent, and it's interesting that it was declared unconstitutional. But as you know, it takes 20-30 years to work its way through the courts. And of course, the whole aim of this was to create conformity with the government's position in the Cold War.
Let's put this in the time frame when the McCarran Act was adopted by the United States Congress and signed into law by President Truman. That was in the late 40s?
Yeah. Early 50s. This is a dangerous precedent, which we did the same thing. The government did the same thing at the end of World War One with the so-called Palmer raids, when thousands of immigrants were deported without due process and railroaded into jails and everything else. And I think I see a dangerous parallel emerging today, too, that worries me a lot. In other words, when we decide that a group of people is declared to be deviant and our enemy, and we do that without due process and without allowing these people to state their side of the story fairly, then we are undermining democracy in a very, very dangerous way. And I think I wanted to tell that part of the story, too, because I don't think people are too much aware of it.
Well, let me ask you about your attitudes towards your children's adopting their own political ideas as they were growing up.
I think that raising children in this period of the Cold War was very difficult if you really believed in free speech. I don't know about yourself. You were probably too young, but my children grew up at the time in New York City in the public schools, and they were told by their teachers and by their government that if a nuclear bomb fell on New York City, that if they ducked under their desk and hid their head with their hands, they would be perfectly safe. Now, you know, a greater lie cannot be spoken than that. It was totally false. And nothing would protect those children if a bomb fell on New York City. And we were forced, we were told that our children were supposed to have dog tags on day and night in case of a nuclear attack so you could identify them. Well, as parents and as people who work for peace and people who work for nuclear disarmament, we could not go along with that. And so it forced us to go to the school and say, my daughter is not going to wear that. And it forced her to become different from the other children, right? Which I regretted, but it was a question of principle. You know, in the horrible, unimaginable event of a nuclear war, there would be nobody to collect those dog tags, nor would there be parents to whom to send them, right? I mean, we know that. So it was this kind of thing. There was a constant pressure for conformity. And on the other hand, we never tried to indoctrinate our children in our ideas. We exposed them, of course, to contacts with people of color and people from other countries and other cultures, that we certainly did, but we felt that they should may find their own way, and they have.
Dr. Lerner, your book ends in 1958. That's 42 years ago, a significant portion of your life, the academic portion, accrued since. Why did you choose to end it then?
Well, because I wanted to tell the story of what went before my successful part of my life started. Because this part of my life that I spent as an academic, you know, is widely available. Everybody can get it on the internet or wherever they want or by reading my books. And it's well known. And I felt that the other part of my life was not at all known. And so I wanted to show that. And I also, it was very important to me to show that I had gone through many decades of struggling with failure of various sorts or with difficulties and obstacles that I had to overcome. When my husband was blacklisted, we had to move. We moved back to New York, and we had to start all over again, economically, totally insecure. And he happened to have made a very brilliant career as a film editor afterwards. But again, we didn't know that. But what happened to me was that my second novel could not find a publisher.
As a result of him being blacklisted, do you think?
No. It had to do with this housing integration, with the subject of racial integration, for which there was no interest in 58. Now, 3 years later, there was a lively interest in it, but I didn't know. I couldn't know that, right? And so I felt really blocked at every route, and so I decided my children were growing up, and my daughter was entering college, and my son was in high school, so I decided I would take a few courses so that I could write a different kind of writing. I thought maybe novel writing was not the way I was going to make a career as a writer, and I was going to write a historical novel. And I wrote started a historical novel on the Grimke sisters from South Carolina, who were the only white women from the South who became active abolitionists. And then I found that I needed to learn more about history to do this. And so I began to take a few courses in history. And that led very quickly to my taking an undergraduate degree. And it took me 4 years of part-time study to get an undergraduate degree. And then I went on to graduate study, and I had a historical biography of the Grimke sisters was my dissertation. And I managed to earn an MA and a PhD in 3 years after that. And that began my academic career.
Well, Dr. Gerda Lerner, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I'd like to ask you to tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately.
Well, I'll recommend a book that takes us back to colonial America, and it reads like fiction. It's by Laurel Ulrich, A Midwife's Tale, and it's a very fine book.
Dr. Gerda Lerner, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
Well, thank you for asking me. It was a pleasure.
Dr. Gerda Lerner, who died on January 2nd, 2013, was a founder of the academic genre of women's history. Fireweed, A Political Autobiography, is her story of her life, up to the time that she entered Columbia University in 1958. Gerda Lerner died on January 2nd, 2013. This interview was recorded in October 2002. Over 400 Radio Curious programs may be found on our website, radiocurious.org. They're free as my gift to you. I hope you enjoy them. Christina Onnestad is our assistant producer. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.
A powerful threat calls for a greater response.
Not tomorrow.
Not in a few years.
But right now.
Some battles must be faced together. Cancer fighters stand up to cancer every day. And you can be part of this battle, too.
Visit standuptocancer.org to learn more.
Together, we can save lives.
Down to the Gulf of Mexico.